today. We have some hearings, some work to do, and we'll kind of jump around the agenda to accommodate our special guests. I want to welcome everybody else who's here with us today. You're all special. But some of our guests are on a time schedule. So let's begin with a public hearing on HJR 18. We'll start with that. I'll open the public hearing, and let's bring up... and we'll also open a public hearing on House Bill 2663 at the same time. Thank you. Let's bring up Senate President Peter Courtney, Representative Ben Westland, and Treasurer Randall Edwards. Why don't you all come on up together? We've got three seats. And we will be pleased to hear from the three of you. Steve, do you want to give us a overview before we...
Thank you. The bill would amend the Constitution and allow the state to issue general obligation bonds up to 0.5% of the statewide real market value of real property. And it would require that the funds be used to match local general obligation bonds raised for pre-K through grade 12 capital costs, and it defines capital costs. And then it would allow or require the Legislative Assembly to repay the bonds from the general fund or other revenue sources. And it specifically prohibits any repayment of the bonds from property taxes either at the state or local level. And it would require the submission of the measure to the voters at the May 2004 primary election.
All right. Thank you. Welcome. Who wants to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I picked the short straw. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and it's a pleasure again to be before this committee to talk to you about something that I think is very critical for the state of Oregon. When we talk about school funding in this building, we've been talking largely about an operational debate that we have each session. That is, how much money should we be putting into the pot to distribute to operating our K through 12 system? This is making sure that we have enough money to give a quality education for our children. And I think we've had a discussion not long ago in my mind that there's been some major policy changes as a result of ballot measure 5, whereby now the funding being here in the state capitol, this has become something that we again debate on a biennial basis. But I also believe that given where we sit today financially and the way in which we have a revenue source for our schools, and we have really taken that from a property tax-based system to an income tax-based system, and the recession that we've hit, I truly believe that the school financing system is broken, and this is going to be part of the charge, I believe, of the state to try to find a better way to fund our public schools. But that doesn't detract from another critical area of funding in our public schools, and that is the capital side. That is investing in the building, the infrastructure, to making sure that the billions that we do invest in the operational side is really being maximized with the capital that we know is out there. And I would say and submit to you that this challenge is as equally daunting for the state and for local communities and school districts to meet as it is on an operational side, and that many school districts across the state are falling further and further behind in meeting this critical need as well. And unlike the operational debate, which as a result of ballot measure 5, 47, and 50, the funding for capital is 100% carried out at the local level. That is, the only way you can raise money to build or remodel or modernize your schools is to ask your local voter in your school district for a property tax and a bond to pay for that. Now, the state does have a role in helping provide some cost savings to those bonds that are being issued through my office, through the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act. We provide the ability for state, for local school districts to use the state's credit rating, which up until recently may have been higher than many school districts, but that has been a very successful program in helping lower the costs of local school issuances of bonds. What we're suggesting today is that we take the next step, and in fact we've already begun that step in looking at how we could have a longer-term partnership in helping defray some of the costs. I think one of the things that is really important, and we passed this out, is to look at really what is the infrastructure of the state of Oregon and our schools. The Secretary of State's office did an audit in May of 2001 and said that the state school system is, and again, this was based on those numbers, is about a $9 billion infrastructure for the state of Oregon. And I think their report, and we just gave you an executive summary, but was very telling about how the system that is financing that infrastructure is not keeping up with the need and the demand in the state. And that each passing year, there is continued deterioration in that capital aspect of schools. And in fact, that they concluded that about $2.4 billion is out there in deferred maintenance and renewal of costs. Part of the reason why school districts have been getting farther and farther behind on their capital needs is in large part because of the operational side of their school budgets. And I would submit to you that as school districts have seen a slowly shrinking budget for their operational side, they have had to defer more and more maintenance in order to keep up with the operational side of the school needs. So we, in this state, in my mind, have to have take that next step and look at a long-term partnership. Many, many states offer a program similar to this, whereby the state would be a partner and match money on a dollar-for-dollar basis, in this case up to 30% of the cost of a local need in their capital, but only after a school district has passed a bond measure would they get a state match. I think, again, local control is important. A debate that we need to again have on the operational side, but I think again the pendulum and the arm of funding our capital side of schools is completely in the local hands, which is appropriate except for the needs are greater than what that tax base can support. So we need to be a partner in the long term in helping meet this need. Just briefly, the way this program is set up is we would use the power of the state's general obligation bond, which is the lowest cost of financing capital in the state, to use as the means to provide the revenue for us to help match these school districts' bond measures. And if you recall, in ballot measure 19, which the legislature referred in the September election, and was supported soundly by the voters, included in there, in that measure, outside of a rainy day fund, a school capital matching fund. Part of this legislation and the implementing law would also begin to implement that mandate of a school capital fund, which again was contemplated by the legislature as well as supported by the voters. So we are already down the path of creating a school matching fund. It's time for us to add the lowest cost of capital to help that, and secondly, to make sure we have the beginnings of a legislative proposal to meet that need. And that's what's embodied in both of these bills, is both in terms of getting an HJR out, that is an amendment to the Constitution to create a general obligation bonding program. The reason we have to amend the Constitution, which isn't something that I take lightly, nor should anybody, but all bonding, GO bonding authority resides in the Constitution. And the reason for that principally is there's a prohibition on the amount of bond indebtedness that the state can carry. And the way we have set up all general obligation bonding authority is to go into the Constitution and set up specific programs. So this is not unique. We have done this for Oregon Health Sciences University. The Senate President, who is here to testify on these bills, had two bills as well last session to address seismic needs of schools and other public safety facilities. Again, all of those were passed, both of those were passed by the voters and were in the Constitution. So again, we're building on a precedent that is there. The language of the HJR is very similar to what we've passed in the past as far as setting up a general obligation bonding program. Again, this, in my mind, is of equal importance to the long-term health of our public schools and the quality of education that we're providing in Oregon. I could give you more detail about the plan. Maybe we could. I'll stop here and let both of these members of the legislature talk and about their interest in this bill, and I could answer any questions after they testify. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Let's pick up the testimony. Who's next? Representative Westland, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Ben Westland. I'm here to testify in favor of HJR 18 and House Bill 2663. Committee, this is important legislation. The citizens of Oregon have invested over $9 billion in public school infrastructure, and currently there exists a documented need of $2.4 billion of building maintenance and renewal. This isn't my opinion or even Ozzie Rose's opinion. This is the Secretary of State's Audit Division's opinion. Our schools are crumbling. This is not legislation that is in any way resemblance of the proverbial handout, but it truly is a hand up for our public schools. School districts must walk their talk to benefit from this much-needed legislation. We all come from districts that all have public schools. We've all toured them. We've all given government classes in them. We have all seen firsthand the state of our public school infrastructure. This bill goes as far as I think the state possibly can to recognizing the need that currently exists in our public schools to provide a decent educational environment in which to learn in. Members, I cannot urge you strongly enough to help pass this important legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Westland. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Shadley and members of the House Revenue Committee. This is truly a, I was just remarking to the State Treasurer, that this is really an outstanding committee you've got here. This is a heavyweight committee.
Are we ready for work session?
No, it is. It's very impressive, Sherry. You do well.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I think the only reason I was asked to be here today by... It was Inger Deckard who asked me to be here. The state treasurer didn't read it, but Inger has briefed me on what I'm going to say. So, and I believe this is why I'm here, is that last session, and this is unfair to Representative Farr and Representative Scott and Representative Berger, but last session we introduced five bills because of the quake, the famous quake, earthquake. And Senate Bill 12, 13, and 14, and then we introduced two resolutions like this, House Joint Resolution for you, Senate Joint Resolution 21, and Senate Joint Resolution 22. And basically, what we were doing with the package, as you recall, we know we're going to get savaged by an earthquake. And so in order to refurbish some of our police, fire, hospitals, and public education facilities, K-12, community colleges, and higher ed, we felt we had to be in a position to sell bonds. And to do that, we had to place on the ballot two very significant ballot measures. And it was, I remember the role this committee played, and I remember, I believe it was Representative Hass who carried these measures on the House floor. Is that correct? He carried one of them or both of them? Was it my mistake there? Because he likes to tell me how good he did and how, you know, well he did, and he always reminds me of that, because I guess one of them was a close call. But here's what's interesting. Both those ballot measures, which sets up this kind of structure. Now, this is a more, they've got their own way, which you're not simply saying by these ballot measures you can just go out and sell all these bonds. It puts in place the authority. You got to come back to the legislature, and, you know, in future sessions of the legislature will decide how much bond authority, et cetera. It's the same structure. But what's fascinating is they went on the ballot in November of this last year. All our names were on that ballot, by the way, with the exception of the state treasurer, because he's in midterm. But all of us here were running for something then. And I was half in the bag then. We won't talk about what my condition was. But I remember that it was state measure number 15 dealt with the public education buildings, and state measure number 16 dealt with the public safety things. And I remember this. I wish Representative Alan Brown was going to be here, because Representative Alan Brown, Peter Courtney, and Mark Hass, by way of a conference call, worked to come up with very straight layperson's language to describe why these were good measures. And I remember we didn't want to talk seismic, and we really did that. But I didn't think those things had a prayer, because they did not have a prayer of passing. I mean that very sincerely, because everything was on. And wouldn't you know, both passed by 56%. And I am reviewing here just for the sake of this state treasurer and also Inger Deckard. I reviewed here the vote count county by county. And it is rather remarkable, because the vote yes was throughout the state of Oregon. Now, there were counties that said no, but there are counties on the coast that said yes. There was Marion County, Polk County, Yamhill County. Hibbert's counties in eastern Oregon said yes. Central Oregon said yes. So it was spread throughout. And interesting, I said both passed by 56%, but I just noted something. The education one got a few more votes than the public safety one. The education one got roughly 671,000 plus votes, and the other one got 669,000. So what I'm telling you is, and I also noted, Mr. Chair, in order to impress you, because you're such a very technical, scientific, research-oriented type of person, that this is not, at this point, before the great work of this committee begins, the Committee of Great People, this measure will not be placed.
Say that again.
Didn't hear it.
This measure will not be on a general election ballot. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair, direct your attention. This is like the days we serve in judiciary.
All right.
Page 2, lines 17 through 20, paragraph 2. It will be placed on the next election, etc., primary election, I believe, May of 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So this one will be placed on that versus November. I don't know what that means in terms of the vote, but I am heartened, really heartened, by what the voters did in this state on a similar measure. I sincerely mean that. At a time when things were pretty dark and dreary, and I think you know what I'm talking about. If you were to go back and look at the November election results on ballot measures and funding measures back in November, I think it was pretty bleak. These two things passed. They passed. And so I cannot support the measure enough. I think the state treasurer has spoken brilliantly to it. It's a great measure. I think you should feel very positive about the fact that the public will support it. And with that, be happy to take your questions, comments, or your criticisms.
Do we have any questions, comments, or criticisms for the Senate President or Treasurer or Representative Wessler? Representative Berger.
Well, I'm coming up against all the heavy hitters here. So all I'll ask is that you just keep an open mind. I'm just wondering why we need to be the benevolent grandfather and come in and save everyone from their either mistakes, mismanagement, or lack of vision. I'm real sympathetic with capital projects for schools. My district, particularly my city of Coos Bay, has been distressed for a long, long time. Just a few years ago, we passed a bond measure for $10 million so we could tear down an old, dilapidated building and build a beautiful new science building. We spent $7 million of the $10 on that, and voters were willing to do that and took $3 million for maintenance. I guess my problem is the fairness issue here is that now someone is going to come in to my neighboring city, North Bend, who needs capital projects and say, don't worry, North Bend voters, we'll give you 50% if you can get 50% passed. Or let's go to Florence, go to any other part of my district. What does that say to the voters who have obligated themselves for the $10 million in the bond measure? We are in dire straits here. We really need to be putting teachers into the classrooms and getting smaller class sizes and doing a lot of things and operating. And I just wonder if the benevolent grandfather is really thinking this through all the way, and that local people don't bear the responsibility of their schools and their buildings. I realize I'm this second term, a sophomore, against the heavy hitters of the state. But I would welcome what you would say about the fairness issue here.
Who wants to take a swing? Representative Weston, sir.
Well, I understand exactly what you said, Representative Verger. I understand and have some empathy for that comment. And while you have just passed your bond measure, I think part of your concern is a timing issue, because undoubtedly you will at some point in the future pass another one, and that this would help you pass another one. And that I believe it's the state's obligation is only 30% is 30%, so maybe we're not quite as benevolent as you're under the impression. But I think the issue to which you speak is that you will, even though you have just passed one, and I know it was difficult, and congratulations on that, all districts throughout the state will at some time, regardless of their where they are in their funding cycle, be able to utilize and benefit from this legislation. I hope that helps address and answers part of your question.
Did either of the other of you want to respond?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Rigger, you know, I didn't identify myself. I'm Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive, North Salem, North, and I live in Salem, and I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes Salem-Kaiser School District. It includes the Jervis School District. It includes the Woodburn School District. But I believe that because of the Oregon Constitution, which says very clearly that there shall be a common school fund established in this state for the educational purposes of the kids across the state of Oregon, that I have a profound responsibility for the kids in Coos and Curry, the kids in Baker and Gilliam, the kids in Deschutes and Hood River, the kids in Lincoln and Tillamook counties, Marion, Polk counties. And the bottom line to me is the kids. If the only thing wrong with kids to me are the adults. Now, I still, the fact that the adults in one area, whether it's because of the economy or whatever, are saying no, and the adults in another area are saying yes, is still the kids. And what I like about this approach is, first of all, we're going to go to the public and ask them to give it the support. We're not going to run it down their throats. It's going to be a vote by the people. There is a match involved. And there's no way we're going to be able to educate the children of this state without the state being involved to some extent for all kinds of obvious reasons. So while you make a very good point, I still wince because I feel I have to be concerned. Even if a given school district or given region of the state is saying no, while others are saying yes, etc., just your point, I still feel I have to step up for those kids in some way. Now, if that makes me big brother or whatever you want, then I'll accept that criticism. But the Constitution does make it clear that there needs to be a common school system in this state for all kids, and that it's our responsibility to make sure if there's inequities, if there are no votes or yes votes, or there's not timber here and there's more property value, whatever it is, we have a profound responsibility to make sure that that kid, when he or she gets that diploma or goes to grade school or middle school or high school, has got their shot. And that's just a philosophical thing that I feel. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's where I'm coming from on these kinds of approaches, and that's why I support them as well. And I'm very sympathetic to what you're saying because, you know, I had to deal with the same thing on the seismic legislation. Like, for example, some school districts are way ahead in building new schools to make sure that their schools are safe from the big nine that's going to hit our states. Others have just got old schools that are just sitting there, like Portland, that could fall down in an instant. But we put it out there. I think we did a good job on it. You were involved in that process. Thank you. So that's my explanation. I humbly accept what you say, but that's the best I can do with your very difficult and timely question.
I would just say that you do include capital projects. We're not talking about the education of the children, but you do include capital projects in that philosophy.
Correct. Yes, I do.
Part of the same.
I will just add one little point, and that is that two graduates of Marshfield High School who have gone on and been very, very successful in another state in the United States have given over $1 million for a wonderful fitness center that's located in the building, which I think is another part that I like in this dynamics of building schools and that people are taking responsibility. These people paid back to Marshfield High School the kind of education that they got there by adding this wonderful, wonderful fitness center into the science building. So thank you for your comments.
Did you want to respond?
Yeah, just briefly. I don't want to leave Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, the potential that, as you described it, the benevolent grandfather, although I don't feel like I'm at that stage in my life yet. Maybe
she's talking to Peter.
Yeah, that's where I thought the question was directed. Really, the way this is set up is the local community has to take the first step. It has to provide well over the majority of money to make this happen. So the state isn't just handing out money without any local control, and I do believe that's been one of the challenges as a result of ballot measure 547-50 is that local control on the operating side is in this building and has been completely taken away from the local community. This, I believe, strikes a balance where we will be a partner but not the lead, and that's the biggest difference. And I think that is really a fundamental policy choice and by design to make sure that the local community passes a ballot measure and understands that the state will help up to 30% of the cost of that measure. And I'm sympathetic about the timing. Just to be clear about that, this is just setting a framework. The bond authority first, the implementing law, and then, as the senator described, you have the keys to the funding and the ability to set this up on the long term, to making sure that we have the ability to meet this need. So this is just setting the framework to, in my mind, to address the long term capital needs, which are, of, as I share the senator's concern, part of the total educational package that this state has got to continue to focus on. It's not just operational, it's the capital side.
You've got a meeting. I want to keep this discussion going. Can you wait about 2 minutes while we break for a quick work session and come back to this? I think this is all very worthwhile. Mr. Treasurer, I know you've got an OIC meeting in Portland.
That's okay.
President Courtney, I assume you've got 15,000 things to do. Representative Westland, I saw you had an unfinished solitaire game on your computer. But if I can ask your indulgence just to recess this public hearing for just a couple of minutes, I want to do a quick work session. I believe we have concurrence in committee on the House Bill 2152. Let me open a work session on that committee. We heard this last week, and really the only question was whether we would proceed with the bill as drafted or whether we would adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which would extend rather than eliminate the sunset, extend the sunset by 2 years, as I recall, looking for my Dash 1 amendments. Okay, Dick says I'm correct. I've had discussion with committee members, and I believe we have the direction of the committee. While I think there is not unwillingness to go forward with the outright repeal of the sunset, I think the path most directly ahead of us is the Dash 1 amendments, which would be the 2-year extension of the sunset. I heard there was somebody that wanted to talk about another 2 cents. Does anyone have an amendment on that? Okay. Thank you very much for not having an amendment on that for now. Committee, we're in work session, and if you're ready to go forward, I am.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2152 be approved.
Representative Verger moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2152. Is there any discussion? Dick? You had some revenue numbers for
us. I just wanted to point out that there is 3 pages in the materials you should have available. Okay. And just very quickly, because I know you're in a hurry, the first page just sort of shows what my model does, and all that's doing is really taking the DAS quarterly forecast and spreading it over months so I can change the tax rate on a given first day of a month and get the effects of that change. The second page addresses the differences in the 3 estimates you had of the impact of the bill, with DHS came in with a number of $30.7 million, I think it was. And at the top in the box there, I come to a $30.3 million, which is following their procedure but applying it to the March forecast rather than the December forecast. Okay. And they've gotten that same number. And the only comment I have on that is that rather than a full half year in the first year it's implemented, they really only get 5 months. So it would be the correct estimate using that method would be about 28.7. What the model does is to use some volume adjustment factors there, cigarette volume adjustment factor and a border population adjustment factor, to predict a decrease in the volume sold as a result of the price increase. And the model then shows for 1 year there, I took 2004-2005, because that's a full year, shows the impact of that volume adjustment. The volume falls from the 203 million packs, which would be under current law, down to 200.23 million. So that's a reduction of volume at 3.32 million. Now that, if you look in the health plan area there, the new rate would raise 20.2 million, and that's very close to the to what DHS estimated. So the volume effect doesn't have a lot to do with that initial 10 cents. But you've got, for the health plan, 86 cents, which applies to a 3 million reduction in volume. And that offsets to a large extent some of their increase. So the figure there, the 17.7, which is the combination for the health plan, of 20.2 less 2.85 is comparable with the number that was on the fiscal analysis, the 24.18, if you take the full almost year and a half that it's in effect. The revenue impact that I gave you then also takes into consideration the fact that the general fund loses some money, the tobacco use reduction account loses some money, and local governments lose some money. And so that's why you come down to about $22
million. Okay. So that's how those numbers all make sense.
Yes. And at the bottom it says, well, what question are you asking? You know, none of them are right.
Which one are you answering?
Well, that's the thing. I'm answering the one which is the last one, the impact on total revenues. Now, to DHS, that may not be a relevant question. They're interested
right.
in what happens to their program.
Sure.
The last sheet is just a sheet I use for tracking cigarette tax revenues. And you can see that as of right now, we're doing all right relative to the last forecast I made. Actually, actual revenues are about $400,000 above what I forecast. But the other question, it was testimony about the fact that we've, you know, to the point where further increases in the tax rate aren't going to generate any more money. And what you had here is an 88% increase in the tax rate. That's only a 16% increase in retail price. But the tax rate increased 88%. And the forecast calls for a 78% increase in revenue. So there is slippage. You're not getting the full increase, but it's still producing substantial additional revenue.
Okay. Thank you for that. I did ask for those revenue numbers. It's not so relevant to the Dash 1 or the bill, but it does tell us at least what we're looking at, what we can expect in the way of revenue for
yes.
the biennium, either
yes.
way we go. All right. Thank you. Yes, Representative Barnard.
On the amendments.
Yeah.
I think I've made it clear in the notes that we passed that I'm opposed to the amendment. I prefer the bill as it stands, and I intend to vote against the amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any further discussion? We have one objection from Representative Barnhart. Are there other objections to the Dash 1 amendments? Hearing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Verger?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that House Bill 2152 be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right, Representative Verger moves House Bill 2152 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on that? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Verger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass.
Aye.
Hobson?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Chair
Federer? Votes aye. House Bill 2152 goes before the due pass recommendation. Do we have a carrier?
I'd be happy to.
You want to carry that? All right. Representative Virgil will carry. All right. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on that. Reopen the public hearing on HJR 18 and House Bill 2663. If we could invite our panel, have we lost the Senate President? Okay, come on back forward. One of the questions. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Farr, you had a question, Representative Nance. Do you need to leave?
I'll jump to you. Okay, well,
okay.
Only point was, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry that Senator Courtney left, is that this bill passed the House with the OHSU bonding and got to the Senate, got in conference committee, and in this room, this component was removed. So I guess my question was for Senator Courtney. Is he had any reason to be more optimistic that it will survive this time around?
I'm more optimistic, but I guess we'll have to ask the senator about that, Representative Hass.
And, you know, who knows? It may have been a matter of just capacity last time. I mean, the sense that we were doing a couple of those, and maybe this is just one extra, which so going on its own, I think is the only thing we have like this coming through this time. It may just be may stand a better chance just moving by itself than it did attached to the other two referrals for constitutional amendments that we did. Representative Farr, and then I'll pick up Representative Barnhart. Thank you, Representative Farr.
Actually, I too
wish Senator Courtney was still here, because I wanted to say that and I've been in public service now for many, many years, and never have I seen such a outstanding, brilliant, articulate, and certainly intuitive panel of experts.
This is compliment day.
Except for you.
Well,
we're in the lab.
To tag along with Representative Verder, I happen to come from a town where any measure that says school on it will pass, whether it's a citywide measure, we just passed a citywide levy, whether it's capital improvements, whether it's building, we tend to pass school measures in Eugene. Like the senator, I believe that we have a responsibility to the entire state and the school kids of the entire state. So I'm firmly behind this.
Thank you.
I appreciate those comments, and I appreciate the fact that Representative Verger was able to pass her last bond. I mean, I come from a district where the largest city in my district, Redmond, Oregon, has failed their last four bonds. You know, we have some of the most crowded schools in the state. Yet, 10 miles down the road in Bend, they rarely fail them. So, if you want to talk to the equity issue and the constitutional requirements of providing an equal and adequate education to all students, I think this helps level the playing field greatly. Not only that, but lowering the cost to our overall districts, because the local school districts are able at that juncture to take advantage of the state's credit rating, and I'm sure Randall will get that back on track here directly. But it does lower the cost of capital, both either construction or renovation for all school districts statewide. So I think there's a real core element here in terms of equity and state school funding overall.
Part of what I heard your question to be was not just that some communities can and some communities can't, but it's a matter of timing that some communities will have just stepped up and borne the full cost of their capital bond measures, and once this passes, then you'll have you'll have the next round will be communities that will just be paying part and still getting the full benefit. Is that
sure.
part of your question?
Sure.
You know, and I understand that. I guess it's always a question of timing. If we'll have to face that at some point, or else we just agree we're never going to do it. The one question that brought to mind is just whether, and I've not given any thought to this, but are these drafted, do you know, in such a way that, you know, would it be possible for a community to pass a measure to refund its bond measure and take advantage of state money somehow in doing it, you know, offhand? That didn't occur to me in reviewing the bill, but her question made me think of it. Could Coos Bay, for instance, right. repass right. a bond measure to refund the measure they just did and then draw on state money for that?
Right.
Maybe that's a question for Chuck.
Mr. Chair, what if... I don't really know. I don't think this bill is written in that way, but we could certainly talk to you about what that might
be. I'm not even necessarily recommending it. I'm not sure that's...
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask about our bond rating. The rating dropping itself in isolation doesn't mean a great deal, provided we don't go out for bonds. In other words, the bond rating is there, but the big issue comes if you go out for bonds. So how does the lower bond rating affect this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, the bond rating doesn't affect this bill. The lowering of the bond rating is an indication of the health of the financial health of the state. And I would submit to you that we still have a good bond rating. We will still have low interest rates, and interest rates are low for Oregon at all levels still, in part just because the market interest rates are low. I don't think, as a policy for the state of Oregon, we never time interest rates. That is, we take advantage of low interest rates, but from a capital perspective, these are long-term, ongoing needs of the state, and we will continue to issue bonds. Again, my mandate as treasurer is to find the lowest interest rates in the market environment that we're in. What this does is gives us a tool to meet a long-term capital need of the state, just like we're trying to do with our roads. I do believe this also has an economic development component to it. That is, we're talking about potentially seeing more money being put into our schools in capital. That can mean jobs. It can also mean the vitality of of these schools. If you've been to a school that has been remodeled, for example, and I've been visiting schools throughout the state of Oregon looking at the capital needs, there is a statewide need. It's all over the state. And those that have been able to get a bond measure passed and revital their schools, it's like a renaissance in that school. That there's a lot of sort of goodwill, good feeling, and that really, I think, translates again into the quality of the education we're trying to provide. I've seen leaky roofs all over the state of Oregon and in places you wouldn't think would have a problem, but when you have snowpack, it obviously, and there's a lot of flat roof buildings in this state, and it's the cheapest way to build them. The time is now really to look at the long-term need of our schools. This is another part of the puzzle, and I want to make it clear this is not a distraction from the operational debate that we must also have, but in the entirety it is part of the debate. And I believe when we talk about a $9 billion capital investment, that puts it at one of the very tops of capital infrastructure in the state of Oregon. So we shouldn't be neglecting it. We have an opportunity to try to help enhance it, and that's what this is about.
Other questions? Representative Barnhart.
I'm not sure this is a question for this panel, but I'm interested in I'm changing topics here, okay, if I can. I'm interested in the dash ones. I'm assuming that that's a part of
the... Are you looking at 18 or...
Sorry, 18-1, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that led me to think about the definition of capital as in this section. I'm wondering if... because of the next clause on the bill that Section 6, this article supersedes any conflicting provision of this Constitution, that this may have the effect of amending the definition of capital costs for the purpose of ballot measure 50, mm-hmm. And whether or not this is a broader definition than ballot measure 50, and whether it includes things like the purchase of furniture to furnish a new building. It's not clear to me just from reading the terms technology and equipment as to whether those things are included or not. Now, this may be the wrong panel to ask this question of. I may want to ask it of a different of somebody else.
Good question. Do you want to take a stab?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, and we could get back to you specifically on that definition, because I think there is a discussion about how broad this is written,
right,
and what's included, so we'd be happy to talk to you about that.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, the reason I ask the question is because I would like a broader definition than we have currently. Schools have horrible trouble, even the ones that can pass bond measures, like in Eugene, have great difficulty buying some of the things that are excluded from a definition of capital in ballot measure 50, and having a broader definition that supersedes that would be fine with me,
okay,
because it's a difficult problem.
Sure. That's probably a good question for counsel or for Chuck, since he's being pointed at by his staff. It raises a couple of questions. What does it mean? This article supersedes any conflicting provision of the Constitution. I think the definition of capital within Measure 5 and Measure 50 is really limited to Article 11. I mean, it says in this article, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that needs to be superseded in order for this definition to apply to this new article. I'm watching knowing nods as I'm speaking here. So I'm curious what needs to be superseded. And the other question I would have for counsel, I guess, at some point would be, if this supersedes conflicting provisions, is this an amendment or a revision? Does it effectively? I don't know.
Well, good point. That was what I hadn't thought of.
Yeah. Good question for counsel. Doesn't affect where we want to go. Somebody is just itching to get up here and answer these questions.
Would you like that, Mr. Chair?
I guess so.
We could get back to you.
Yeah, those are technical questions.
We could get back
obvious
to that.
That we need to answer. Other comments or questions for these folks?
I also want to note, Mr. Chair, for the record, that the State Superintendent is also supportive of this package, and she submitted a letter in support of him.
Yeah, well, I think we struck out, and maybe you could say that in both senses of the phrase, last session with this measure. We struck out with it, and we struck out in the Senate with a strong endorsement of the policy and direction. I think this is just a matter of this session again of getting some of these questions answered so that we can move this forward. The other question I guess I have Senator Courtney was talking about this paragraph 2 of H.J.R. 18 be submitted to the people, special election on the same date as the next, I guess that would be next May, that's right.
It is.
It would be too late, even if we were to get this out lickety-split. It'd be too late to get out to May this year anyway. That's not a primary election. That would be a special May election, not a primary election. So we are talking about May 2004.
We are.
Okay.
And that, again, could be debated on whether or not that's the right timing as well.
Okay. And the last question I would have, maybe related to Representative Barnhart's question, but you made some comment, too, Mr. Treasurer, in your testimony. We have a definition of capital or capital cost in Measure 19. This is different than that. And I guess, just for the record, in order to bring those two into concurrence, it would take a revision to bring the definition of capital in 19 into alignment with the definition of capital in this one. So it's unfortunate, I suppose, that we have to create two separate school capital matching funds, but that seems to be the direction we're headed in, unless we decide we're going to make this a revision. Is that about right?
Your premise is right, that suppose if we had gone back, we might have changed about Measure 19, that language of that subaccount. But that, as it may, again, that it would, this would create a separate fund to, which again, the department would manage both accounts,
right,
to meet the capital needs of the state. If you'd like, we could have our counsel give you just a brief sort of perspective on the revision question now.
Sure.
And any other legal matter.
Right. And we'll let, unless there's any more for the Treasurer or for Representative Westland, we'll let you stand down. Appreciate you spending this much time with. Oh, sure.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Verger's concerns keep lingering in my mind, and she brought up another point that I think needs to be addressed, and I don't think we have adequately answered here at the witness stand. And I believe you were making some references to those districts that manage well and take care of their capital cost and have not had to let their buildings go into some larger state of disrepair. And I think that's a valid concern, and God bless, and I mean that reverently, those districts that for whatever reasons, good management, students coming back and blessing them with additional capital grants or bequests, more power to them. But this bill in no way punishes those districts or puts those districts at a disadvantage in the future. All this does is give those districts that have proven to be good stewards, you know, the exact same advantage as those districts that have, for whatever reasons, a more difficult time with setting aside money in a sinking fund for long-term capital repair projects.
Thank you very much for those comments. I appreciate that.
And, you know, it comes to mind, too, I think of Fall City when I think of a bill like this or a measure like this. Those folks, they just don't have a tax base that they could ever raise, on which they could ever raise the money to rebuild their high school that has to be rebuilt someday because it's going to fall down. And that's not an issue of mismanagement on their part or failure to attend to maintenance and repair. They've just got an old school, and they don't have a tax base that, you know, that will ever support the capital cost of replacing a modern-day high school facility, and I have a feeling there are a lot of schools and a lot of communities like that that have needs that are just beyond their capacity in this day and age to fund as well as provide operational funding from their limited tax bases. And so and the fairness thing, I guess you look over time, there are communities who will just have passed and borne the 100% cost of their own capital measures, but next time those communities come back to the well for capital improvements, they'll have this tool available to them. So I think you look at fairness over time as well as just this narrow window around the time of passage of this. Good discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, do you want to answer our questions?
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying to win my fifth game in a row, Mr. Chair.
If you put that six of diamonds under the seven of spades, I saw you missed that one.
Yeah.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Burns. I'm with the Attorney General's Office, and I represent the Office of the State Treasurer. If I understood your questions correctly, one of them had to do with the differing definitions in this proposed constitutional amendment versus the definitions of capital costs that are in what are commonly known as Measures 5 and 50 that also deal with local government bonding and finance issues. The definition in proposed HJR 18 is broader than the definitions of capital costs under Measures 5 and 50, and that was intentional. And the definition set forth in HJR 18 applies only to this measure. It wouldn't amend the definitions of Measure 5 and 50. But what it would allow is for a local district to go out and have its own bond measure, have a project that would include costs that can be bonded within the Measure 5 and 50 limits, but also within the total project would include costs that are outside those limits that could be picked up by the state in its up to 30% grant.
Yeah.
Well, a question then so that I understand what this actually does. Under this definition, would a school be able to buy furniture, books for the library, things that, in my mind at least, don't generally fall under the term equipment, but maybe they do for this purpose?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Barnhart, I have to confess that I am not an expert on local school district finance, and I know that that term equipment has been interpreted in some context within Measure 5 and 50 and things like that. I'm fairly certain that equipment would include things like stuff for the science building and computers and things like that. I can see that it could be interpreted broadly enough to include books and things like that, but I'm not certain that how that term has been interpreted. I'd have to get back to you.
Answer, maybe with bond counsel. Mm-hmm. Those are the folks who have to answer those questions to the districts, whether this is broad enough to comprehend furnishing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, when we're dealing with this kind of a measure, we're trying to encourage districts that have real difficulties dealing with capital costs, especially in the environment when our operating cost money is so slim. Putting some care into this definition so that we actually do cover the real cost of a new building, including all these things, I think is important.
Representative Chair, Representative Barnhart, what we could do is check with bond counsel and make sure.
A question I had then, maybe you could answer, Ms. Burris, the question I had about this language, again, you're not the drafter of the bill, I know, but supersedes any conflicting provision of the Constitution?
Yeah.
Why do we need that, and does it create a revision?
Representative Chair, I don't believe that it creates a revision. The language is in there, actually, I think, to be extra cautious, and also because the language of this measure, because we have recently passed the Oregon Opportunity Bonds, which became Article 11L, Articles 11M and 11N, which you referred to earlier for the seismic rehabilitation, and this would then be Article 11O, and they're all for the same purpose of issuing state general obligation bonds, so we modeled this language on that prior language that was in all of those. It really, I think, is just a codification of a common principle, which is later in time amendments will control over earlier provisions. The fact that this language is in here, I don't think creates a revision to the Constitution, because to have a revision, you have to actually amend more than one section of the Constitution. This is creating a new section that would allow authority for general obligation bonds, and it's permitting the issuance of general obligation bonds, notwithstanding the limitations set forth in Article 11, Section 7, which say that the state can't incur indebtedness of more than $50,000. And that's the way every state general obligation bond program has been set up since the first one was enacted.
So this language has been in every...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That gives me some comfort. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions for Ms. Burris? All right, thanks for being available.
Thank you.
Let's hear from, let me bring up three together here, I think, together. Steve Louder, Ozzy Rose, and Deborah Summer.
Yes.
Please come forward. And we are in public hearing on both HGR 18 and 2663. I saw you signed up on both, so feel free to be expansive in your testimony, but concise.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'll start. I'm Ozzy Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and I could have brought all of the superintendents in Oregon here to support our support of these two measures, but we brought a representing sample of the superintendencies. We have gender equity. We have equity on the committee. Two of them are from your districts, so forth and so on. Seriously, we are supportive of these measures. We believe it's important that the state help play a role with rebuilding and maintaining the infrastructure in our K-12 system. And the earlier discussion about the size of the infrastructure system and its condition is not an Oregon unique issue. Our infrastructure system in K-12 across our nation is in difficulty. And the deferred maintenance question, the moving of populations are behind that. And in times of distress, financial distress, maintenance gets deferred in favor of operations. And you have to serve the kids. And discussions about whether some districts mismanage or whatever, the reason they're there, are for a variety of things. But the primary reason there are differences and there are difficulties is that the first thing a district has to do is serve the kids every day that show up. And you put off some other things because you have to do that. Representative Verger's concern is a valid concern, but Representative, had the legislature listened to us 25 years ago, your last two or three bonds would have been covered. We've been asking for this kind of support for a long time. The 30% is an effort to point out that not all districts have the same resources. We have equity developed pretty well in our operations side, but we have ignored it on the capital side, and we've talked about it for 5 to 10 sessions, and that's what this is about. This second thing that's important in this measure is the last thing discussion you had, and that's about the broadening of the term capital. And I don't know how broad equipment is. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly. I have a hunch it doesn't cover books, but it covers a lot of stuff that we currently can't cover. And when you can't cover them with their capital money, the districts have to take it out of their operations money. And those of you been on the committee know that we have put into the formula a facilities factor in part to try to take care of that, but it doesn't come anywhere near addressing the issue of the things you have to do in a new building to get it ready to operate that you can't pay for out of the bond. The other side of that issue is if you go too far, the argument against the broad definition is you shouldn't bond over 20 years for something that's going to last 3. And so there's a valid reason to be concerned about that definition. But there is a need to let us put equipment, things, I think the current definition has to be bolted to the wall or something to be considered capital. But there's a lot of technology and a lot of things we do now in buildings that can't meet that, and this would be helpful in that. We encourage your favorable consideration of both bills with as broad a definition of equipment as you can get by people who don't think you ought to have a broad definition. I'll end now and let the superintendents talk to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Steve Louder. I'm the superintendent of the Tigard-Tualatin School District. I'd like to thank you for allowing us to speak in favor of both measures before you today. As Ozzy was saying, there is certainly a broad issue of infrastructure need out there. Our district is a unique district. We are one of those fortunate districts that has a high assessed value. I think our district's assessed value is over $5 billion. To that end, we were able to pass, with overwhelming support of our community, a bond measure last year for about $86 million. Now, while that sounds like a huge number, and it is a huge number, our needs are far greater than that number. Clearly, a district, and I have had the pleasure of serving in very poor districts and in a district like Tigard-Tualatin, which is relatively a wealthy property district. Both districts need this kind of support. The infrastructure needs of our district go beyond the bond that we just passed. We could certainly have used another $25 or $30 million to rebuild Tigard High School. We are going to be able to put in about $13 million, but it's far from meeting the needs of that high school. The issue of equity is a very important one. And again, I said I had the experience and the opportunity to work in districts that just did not have the capacity to raise a bond to do anything. They didn't have the value in their districts to actually do anything with that small amount of money, which is quite unfortunate. So there's a great need across the state and, as Ozzie said, across the nation for this. I've had the pleasure of working in three states now, and it's been the same issue in all three states. The infrastructure needs, facility needs have been great. So this would go a long way to helping school and their infrastructure needs. And that equity issue is very important. I too would encourage you to keep that definition of equipment quite broad. That's a very important issue. Our needs are quite broad. Our general fund capacity is very, very limited, especially in these times, and a resolution like this that would help districts with a broader definition of what we can purchase and what we can do with the money would be very, very helpful from large districts that are property rich or to very poor rural districts that are property poor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lauder.
Good morning. My name is Deborah Sommer. I'm currently the superintendent of the Canby School District. And formerly, I was superintendent in South Tillamook County in Estufa Valley. And I'd like to share two experiences in terms of the reality of trying to pass and implement a bond at the local level. In Canby, we passed a $30.8 million bond in spring of 2000. Representative Scott served on that bond campaign committee and was instrumental in our ability to get those funds. It took 6 years to pass that bond. And we had two failed efforts, and the final one passed with a 57% majority in a double majority election. The two prior times that the effort failed, it lost by fewer than 200 votes. It took us 6 years to get those funds, and by the time those dollars came into the school district, two things became obvious. One, to get the measure to ultimately pass, we had scaled it down every time we went out to the voters. We had needs for two new schools, remodeling infrastructure, a lot of needs. We scaled them down consistently each time in order to find the magic number that our voters would support. By the time the measure passed at $30.8 million, we had insufficient funds to meet all of the needs that we had started with 6 years earlier. And secondly, the cost of what we were able to do with the dollars we were given had continued to rise over that period of time. That's a dilemma that every school district faces, even when they're successful. By the time we got the dollars, the cost had increased, but along with that came public expectations that that bond was going to take care of our facility needs for the next 25 years, which, of course, it will not. We now have the dilemma in Canby of having spent those dollars. We're at the end of that process, 3 years and four summers of a lot of work, nothing fancy, roofs, HVAC, infrastructure for wiring for the internet, sidewalks, paving, nothing extravagant. Our voters believe that we're done. And not only are we not done, but we only got half of what we needed the first time. We got land for a new facility, for a brand new school to deal with overcrowding, and now we have the dilemma of going back to our public and saying we need another $40 million to build a middle school. In these economic times, that's going to be a tough sell. Coupled with that is the fact that Canby has a bit of a gap in terms of a local option, and we are now going to mount a six-week campaign to try to get $1 million in operating dollars to offset the $2.7 million in cuts we face for next fall because of the state shortfall. So we have the other dilemma, which is if we go out to our public and if we're successful with a local option, they will continue to confuse operating dollars with facility dollars. They think they've already given it the well once. accounts, and will we jeopardize ultimately our ability to get that new school long-term for our school district? How many times can you go to your voters and try to explain what is a very complicated set of variables that we're dealing with in public schools? This measure would be very helpful to us. I believe it provides a viable incentive to local voters to leverage local funds. They need to be responsible at the local level, but we could certainly use the help that this legislation would provide.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there questions for any of these three witnesses? Representative Berger?
I have a question for Ozzie. I see you, Ozzie, as being someone that has always been fairly interested in statewide education in schools and in all of our students, and I mean that sincerely. I think you really have done that. How do you see this particular bill playing out in our schools in Oregon that are so different, the high-growth area and the declining school enrollment? In other words, will the high-growth areas just simply qualify by criteria for this kind of bonding assistance over Mapleton or Reedsport that have declining enrollment? And how will there be a fairness issue addressed in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, all districts will qualify in the same manner if it's set up the way it's proposed. The state will provide a 30% match. And so the declining, your district in particular with a declining economy would be able to say to its voters, for every dollar that you'll put up, we will get $1.30 worth of product in our school system. And it'll be the same everywhere. And for the, I believe it's more important to that, to the lower, Beaverton sells its bonds under the current system. It's got growth and so forth in it, and it can sell them. But they also, to raise a dollar, have a lot, they don't have to make as much effort for that dollar as your people do. And so I think the argument to your folks that, look, if we'll make this effort, we're going to get a return for it that makes it worth our investment, helps us have a good system in Coos Bay. So I think it's equally helpful to all of them.
Sure. However, won't the bonding be somewhat limited? I mean, you can't just keep bonding on and on and on and on. So there are just going to be so many schools that are going to be eligible. I think going back, are the high-growth schools just obviously more eligible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think you're asking, will the high-growth schools eat up the available bond and available money? That's going to be a issue for your future legislature, how much they make available. And it's my assumption that once you put this in place, everybody doesn't pass a bond the same year. Those things roll out like this. And I assume that the legislature will have to establish a pattern of increasing the bonding capacity to meet the need. Because it just says we will provide 30% match. By the way, the other thing...
match not exceeding 30%.
Right.
And that's going to depend on how much is available and what the demands are on the fund.
I suspect that my successor and others will have enough out there to meet the 30%, with all due respect, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I wouldn't just want to make any false... Yeah.
The other thing about this, we're talking about a vote in 04 primary. That means 05 session will be the first one to look at it. If you decide to sell bonds in 05, you sell them late 05 or maybe early 06. So the first time schools even get a shot at discussing this is probably the 06, 07 school year. So it takes a long time. And Measure 19, we kind of got a little bit lucky at getting the concept in there, but we didn't get any money. We had the concept on the books, but we don't have any money. And it'll be a long time before money's in there. If we, you have to fill up the endowment or the other fund first. So this is the first shot where we've had a relatively short, but it's still a four-year timeline before you actually have assistance for the districts.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's bring up David Williams, last witness signed up. So if anybody else wants to testify, let me know before I close the hearing. I'm bringing up Lori Wimmer Wayland too. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, members of the committee. David Williams, representing the Oregon School Employees Association, and I hope you don't mind, Lori Wimmer with OEA decided to come along as well. We just wanted to be on the record and let you all know that we firmly support this piece of legislation as we did last session. The OSCA represents 20,000 classified school employees, specific segment of that being maintenance and custodial. A big selling point for us is along the lines of questions Representative Barnhart was addressing earlier, and that is the language relating to capital costs and what's included in that. As you probably are all aware, there's enormous deferred maintenance costs around the state. Many buildings have progressed to the point where due to budget constraints and whatnot, districts have been only able to supply routine custodial services rather than maintenance costs to maintain the buildings at their top condition. And these are costs we hope will be addressed through this type of program and this expanded definition of capital costs. I've submitted written testimony and I urge you all to read that as well. The main point of this, we think this is just another tool in the toolbox for school districts to deal with all the costs facing them around the state, rural, urban, high growth, and declining enrollment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, and we too would like to voice our support for the bill as we did last session. One time when I was giving a presentation at Lebanon High School on the legislative process, I had the unfortunate experience of walking down a hall and seeing a plate glass window to their courtyard explode before my face and shatter, fortunately missing all the students lined up at their locker at the time. And it was one of those moments where the personal experience becomes informs the political. We've seen the leaky roofs and the deferred maintenance vividly in our travels around the state, and so we too support any tool that will help schools keep up with the capital construction and maintenance needs. The one piece that we had concern about that I bring to your attention is the piece about the local share in terms of the match. We don't have any problem with the amount of local match. We just would like the source of that to be a little bit more flexible than stated. If, for example, there were other sources of money besides bonding that local districts might in some future date have access to, an illustration might be if ever there were an SDC for schools kind of law in place, it would be our hope that the committee could write an amendment with some, to allow the district some local flexibility in terms of the source of the local matching money so that that could be included instead of borrowing. With that, I'd be happy to accept any questions.
Lori, do you know? That's an interesting question. Is that limitation in the joint resolution, or is it in the bill?
Pardon?
2663. It's in 20. Yeah. So that's statutory. We can fix that any time. I don't think that limitation is in the resolution.
All right.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, I'm sorry.
Chair, I have one question for Lori. I'm sorry to dominate the meeting today, but I really have some serious questions about this. As coming up from the OEA position, we have such operational needs, and we want to have more teachers, and we want teacher standards met, and all the good things that you and I both are interested in. There are only so many things you can go to the voters for. And I go back to the lady that was here before. I think that's an extremely valid point. One of the reasons that the local option has not been used by cities in years past is they did not want to choose the local option, which wouldn't produce too much revenue, and they would hold off so that they could get a better ballot measure through. Are you at all concerned that the operating part of it will suffer as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, you raise a very good point, and it's one of those struggles I think every district has had with respect to bonding a local option at the local level. As a matter of fact, Beaverton's situation comes to mind as they're rapidly trying to slap up new schools to keep pace with their enrollment growth. They have, up until now, I think they're about to go up for their very first local option levy, but up until now they've avoided it for that very reason. They don't want to basically foreclose their options with respect to their capital needs. I think that these aren't easy questions, and simply providing the tool is not the same thing as saying that we suggest that it always be used. Timing will be an issue, and there will be all kinds of balancing acts on an individual basis when it comes time to actually consider pursuing this. I think we just support coming up with as many creative options as we can to try to fulfill all the needs of schools on both the operational and the capital side.
All right. Thank you very much. John Marshall, you look ready to spring.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I don't think I can add much to what's already been said, but in terms of the need, one only has to look at the list of school districts over the last several years that have gone out for bond measures, both in school districts that can't seem to build school districts or school buildings fast enough because of increasing enrollment, school districts with very severe structural needs for aging school buildings, and even school districts with declining enrollment that may choose to consolidate may need resources to expand existing facilities to accommodate students that come from the consolidation. In response to some issues raised by Representative Verger regarding how this money might be distributed, that, I believe, will be a challenge no different than how we decide and struggle with distributing the allocation to the state school fund. We have 198 school districts, all in varying degrees of circumstances, and I envision perhaps a triage approach, where we would prioritize, if there's a pot of money to distribute, we would identify the greatest need. And in a particular year, that may be school districts with severe needs in terms of repairing aging facilities. In another year, that may be school districts with severe needs relative to building new school buildings to meet growing capacity. I think what we have to focus on now is to create the structure in place that will allow us to have that pot of money. Once we have that pot of money, then we would welcome the challenge to determine how to equitably distribute it throughout the state. What we have here is a foundation, and we need to get the foundation in place to give the treasurer the authority, and then once we have that foundation, we can build on that in the future. Once this is approved, which we're hopeful it will be, then the challenge becomes, where do we find the revenue stream that will pay the debt service? That is, where will the funds come from that we can issue these to pay off the bonds that will be issued? And that's the next hurdle. But we're hopeful that you'll at least put the foundation in place, and then we'll gladly accept the challenge to build on from there. With that, I'll conclude, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Barnhart. John,
this is not really a question.
Oh, okay.
It's a comment on the question that was raised earlier. I note that in Section 3 of the bill, one of the things that it says is that, or maybe it's Section 4, where I've lost track. No, it's in Section 3. It says that that 50% of the total cost of the project has to come from local general obligation bonds. 30%, maximum 30%, can come from this bond, and so 20% presumably can come from somewhere else.
I suppose that's true even under the bill. Yeah.
Even under the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, under the constitutional amendment, I don't know whether it's ambiguous or not, but it does require that in order to qualify for this money, top of page 2, schools must have received voter approval for local general obligation bonds,
right,
although it doesn't specify the amount. So presumably that triggers for this, even under the constitutional amendment, is that there has to have been a voter approval locally,
right,
for the issue.
Some bond component
effort.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Does anybody else wish to be heard on either HJR 18 or House Bill 2663? What I'd like to do, maybe, Steve, before we bring this back for work session, let's get an answer to our question on the definition of capital costs in HJR 18 so we are confident what that encompasses. And then something I'd like to hear on 2663, just for our information purposes, if we could bring somebody from the department. Section 3, sub 3 says that the State Board of Education may adopt rules including criteria for distribution of grants to school districts. I'd be interested to know what kind of direction they might, not that I would expect the rules to be granted, but what they would be looking at in criteria that we could expect to see into this, just the administration of it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. On HJR 18, page 2, line 3, the definition of the capital costs, I hope, is done in conjunction with the definition for operating costs, because when you start getting into books, be they library books or classroom textbooks, where do you cross that line?
Right. I agree. One thing to bond furnishings, perhaps another thing to bond books. Yeah. Representative Bridger?
Will we have any idea of the revenue source before we actually go into work session?
Well, the revenue, well, the as I understand, there will be a $1 appropriation in this session to establish the fund, and then it would take action in the next legislative session to actually authorize the issuance of bonds, and those bonds then would constitute the revenue source for this matching fund. And then the debt service on those bonds would just be paid out of, that'd be general fund debt service. Am I right? There is no dollar amount at this point. The only, there's 2663 has a dollar. It takes it out. Thank you. And that 2663 doesn't even have a dollar. So the revenue, you want to come on up, Randall?
The debt service.
The debt service would be general fund, as I would expect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you're raising really.
I'll put
we have a donation, Mr. Chair.
And I'll answer.
Wait, don't. That's our ending balance. Keep it. We may need it.
Mr. Chair, let me just state, and I think this keeps raising itself, and that is, how would we pay for this program? The key point here is to set up, as was described by John Marshall and others, a framework by which we can begin to address a long-term need. I think what's critical is that, just like on the operational debate that we're going to need to have in this building, which is an adequacy and a long-term, how are we going to better fund our public schools? I think it's fair to say we have a crisis in our schools that you're going to be seeing again play out as we continue to wrestle with a budget in this building. This has to be part of the discussion, and that is, again, as the chair outlined, it's going to take a number of years, even with this framework, to have the ability to start funding this. And again, I think as we have a debate about school finance, it's right at, I wouldn't say it's more important, but it is of equal importance in many cases for school kids to get a quality education, to make sure that the buildings that they're in are meeting the objective that we're asking them to meet. Overcrowded class sizes, I think, again, mentioned, there's a capital cost. If you're going to try to lower that to, again, improve the quality of education, there's a capital component. Again, this is setting up a framework to allow us to take advantage of, again, a voter-approved ballot measure 19, which contemplated a school match. It, as the chair outlined, this was a concept that actually did pass the House, and it did not get out at the end of the session in the Senate. I do believe there's a great deal of support, and the debate about financing this, like financing the operational side, has got to be a debate that we in the state engage. And this has got to be part of the debate. And that's why we're bringing this forward again, this session, because, as Ozzie described, this has been an issue that's been around for quite some time.
Okay, thank you. Steve has confirmed that the chair was correct, and I love that when that happens, that, in fact, the appropriation is still in the bill. Section 6 and 7 appropriate a dollar. The amendments take out the limitation in 8 and 9, but they still, the appropriation is still in. It is. If you want to take it out, we'll need another amendment to take it out, but it's still in.
The intent was to take it out,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right. Then we need to fix the amendment.
Then we might get Mr. Barnard's dollar.
Something else to deal with the amendments then. Okay, I look forward to having this back.
Thank you.
We will get another chance to look at this with those amendments and some further discussion, and appreciate your time with us today.
Thank you.
And your staff. All right, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2663 and H.J.R. 18, and let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2664. Ms. Beth, that's you.
Yes.
Thank you. This will be a very short hearing. Yeah. No one signed up to testify.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. With House Bill 2664, it has a dash one amendment, so I'll just tell you what the dash one amendment does in conjunction with the bill. And basically, this is dealing with the Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Program, and it is allowing unused contributions to this the College Savings Network, which is the new term that is now being used, to be claimed as a deduction in subsequent years until the total amount of the contributions are claimed as a deduction. It's also allowing Oregonians to contribute to the College Savings Program up until April 15th, or the day on which the taxpayer files an income tax return, whichever date is earlier. It deletes references to the Qualified Tuition Savings Program and inserts the College Savings Network. It replaces then the Oregon Qualified Tuition Savings Board with the Oregon 529 College Savings Board. So basically, under current law with this program, a person, you know, establishes an account and they make a contribution, and either the account owner or a designated beneficiary must be a resident of Oregon. And then these payments are used then to pay for any qualified education expenses that may be paid jointly to the beneficiary and the higher education institution, or directly to the higher education institution when they go to school. But in beginning in 2001, the annual contributions up to $2,000 was what was allowed per return. $1,000 for married filing separately could be subtracted then from your gross income, and that's how the deduction worked. The account earnings are tax deferred until the time of withdrawal by the beneficiary, and it also last session you had a bill that clarified that the non-qualified withdrawals from the savings program are subject to tax. So now this particular bill will have a revenue impact. I haven't had a chance to do it yet. It really will depend on basically how much the contributions are above $2,000, because that's what's allowed right now under current law. I'll be going through those accounts and reconciling how many are above $2,000. And in future, it's basically allowing, like we have carry forwards with credits, this is going to allow like a carry forward for a deduction. And there are no deductions currently that have carry forwards.
Okay. Treasurer, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be here again.
Still.
For the record, Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. I really appreciate the committee's indulgence on this bill as well, House Bill 2664. I want to give you just kind of a quick update on the Oregon College Savings Plan and kind of where we are today, where we've come from, where we are, and where we're going, which I think this bill really embodies some changes that we've been making over the last couple of years, and I think, again, a direction that has really put Oregon on the forefront in the College Savings Plan arena. Michael Parker, who is the executive director of the program, will give you some specifics about the bill, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions. I want to say that I really believe that the Oregon College Savings Plan has really been one of the bright lights in the state. Some of the things that we've been able to offer Oregonians, the response to this program has been overwhelming, and I think something that Mr. Chair, you and a couple others on this committee, when we started this bill four years ago, I don't think really anticipated what the response would be, and I want to compliment you and this committee in the last year and continue to make refinements to make this a very attractive investment for Oregonians. And as I said, well, this program started 2 years ago when I took the reins of the Treasury. I opened the first three accounts in the state with my three measly checks. And since that time, Oregonians have responded extremely well to this. We have seen almost $100 million invested in a two-year period of time. This at a time, if you recall, and you still are experiencing, one of the fastest bear markets or the falling of a market that this country's ever seen. So at the time when the markets were falling, people were looking at this as an opportunity to put money aside for the long term. And I think that has been a testament to the fact there's a great need in this state for people to save for college, and people are willing to step up and make that happen. Let me just briefly tell you what the College Savings Plan is. I think staff outlined it in a succinct way. it was really an opportunity that Congress gave states to set up to help set up an investment savings account, if you will, and that's what we created. Other states have also have a tuition program, a prepaid tuition program that has guaranteed tuition rates if you invest in their program. We did not take that path, and maybe it was by luck. Those states that have created that are having an enormous challenge right now meeting that liability, because tuitions have risen across the country, as they have in Oregon, and the market has gone down. So they're trying to make up for lost ground, which some programs had to be stopped because of that financial imbalance. This is truly an investment vehicle, and the risk is on the investor. Our job is to provide a quality investment, a broad range of choices, and the ability for Oregonians to understand that this is available to them. And that really has been a mandate that I take seriously, is to make sure that Oregonians continue to see that this is out there for them. Like any investment product, you can't say that this is the only one or the best one for them, but it does have some unique features that I think has made it very attractive. It's a very low entry to get into the program. You can open an account with as little as $25 a month through direct deposit. It has significant tax benefits, both in terms of federal and state. On the state level, you can, for the first $2,000 you put in each year, you can take a tax deduction. On the federal level, which again, we last session and you helped us pass, we got ahead of the feds, and that is all the earnings under this are no longer taxed at the state and federal level. Again, a significant tax advantage of allowing people to have more money at the end of the day of their savings. The other thing that's unique about this program is that it's very flexible. It's flexible in its use. You can use this money and a variety of private public institutions throughout the country. It can be used any time in your life. So, in essence, as we know, many people go through career changes, need to get additional education in their life. They could set this up and continue to draw on it throughout their life. And after that, if they continue to have money or want to pass that on, they can pass it on to the next generation. So it really has an enormous ability for families, individuals, to meet their educational need. It can be used at both two-year, four-year, graduate school level. Again, so those who want to go back and get technical training at an accredited college or university can do that. It really does meet a broad range of needs of Oregonians and citizens in the country. We've been really trying to build on the success of this program since we started it, and we've, over the last couple of years, have expanded our partnerships. We brought on two other partners, private sector partners, in addition to Strong, who was the original partner that the state had partnered with to offer this as mutual funds to Oregonians. We brought on MFS, which is a large mutual fund company out of Boston, and U.S. Bank First American Funds as another partner in this program. And the reason why we brought these other partners into this was to, again, offer choice to Oregonians. I think the challenge is that there are many people with a lot of different experiences in investing, and clearly trying to meet that mandate is really a challenge, and therefore we've tried to expand giving people an opportunity not only through whether it's a direct investment through a broker or you calling up or going online. Again, another opportunity, you can use this program, go online and register through a no-load fund. Again, people have a variety of interests and sophistication, if you will, in how to invest money, and we're trying to meet that. So again, I think that's been a very successful part of meeting some of the challenges before us and the Oregonians. We're also exploring other partners. We in this since we started this program, have a number of companies that have put this program in their payroll system or have offered it as a way for their employees to invest for something that they think is important for their employees. We are beginning to explore relationships and trying to see if we can get the tribal governments to put this in to their meeting some of their needs of their members. Again, this has tax advantages that could be beneficial to them. I am really happy also to report that since we started this program, we started it with an advance from the legislature to get it going. And since that time, in last session, we were able to pay back our first advancement of this. This program is freestanding. It is a self-supported program. Again, the goal of this was to get it to a point where we had enough assets that it would not be any cost to the general fund of the state, and we are in the process of paying back more of that advancement in this biennium as well. So I think, again, a success, a testament to how well Oregonians have responded to this, and the continued growth of this, I think, is going to be a very powerful indication that Oregon wants to help its current generation and future generations to meet an educational need. With that, I'd like to pass it over to Michael Parker, who is the executive director, to maybe just run you through the bill quickly and the dash ones, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. I know you do have an OIC meeting in Portland. Do you need to be on your way?
I could take questions
okay.
now. Yeah, that would be helpful.
Have questions from committee? Yes, Representative. Let me look down this way first. Okay, Representative Barnhart.
I may have missed something.
I always look to my right.
Mr. Treasurer, but I'm wondering, is this bill designed to bring this law into conformity with the federal law or for some other purpose?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's mostly how we administer this program here in Oregon. The name change, while it sounds small, the college savings, these plans are being recognized as 529 plans around the country, so we're trying to embed that into the name. It has become more of a network. That is, now we have other vendors, as I described, who can offer investment opportunities for Oregonians. So, while that sounds sort of on the sort of a veneer type of issue, it really can help us in marketing this program so that the public, as they're getting more and more educated about 529 plans, again, other states do offer them. They can offer it in our state, and so we're trying to make sure we're on equal footing. Most of this is just housekeeping to improve the ability for Oregonians to invest in this program. For example, trying to give right now, you can put in for your tax year. You can only, at this point, the limitation is you have to put money in by the end of the calendar year. As you know, many people don't start thinking about tax advantage until tax time. So we're trying to extend this, as you do with other investment vehicles, to up to the tax date. So you can take advantage of taking putting money in this program up until the filing.
So like an IRA.
Like an IRA, exactly.
You can take the credit, the subtraction for the prior calendar year.
And there's a lot of data that shows that we've looked at this, that, you know, there is a spike towards the end of the calendar year, and we also know that there are a lot of people who do wait until the end of closer to April to make a contribution. So we're trying to really push this in a way to get it more aligned with what, again, the public is going to, I think, find beneficial to them. Staff talked about a fiscal or revenue impact. I'm not sure what that number is going to look like, because what we're trying to do is give those who, and there are some, and I would say some, there, I don't think there are a lot of people who put a large lump sum of money into these plans to start them, which in some ways is a good thing because you get the compounding effect. Those who do that, greater than $2,000, if they only put in one lump sum, they cannot take that tax deduction but only that one year. The federal government actually allows you to put, as a gift tax, you can front load your gift tax to a beneficiary of $55,000. And now it's $11,000 per year, and you can take that gift tax deduction over the next 5 years off your federal taxes. So in some ways we're trying to mirror what the federal policy is so that there is an advantage. And I think, again, I don't think a lot of people do this. Again, it's $2,000 can be a lot of money. But the point is, those who can and do should have some advantage to the tax deduction that those who don't do that and put in a fixed money share have that opportunity as well.
Okay. Let me rephrase the question. It sounds as though part of what you're saying is that these changes would allow the state to take advantage of flexibility allowed under 529 that we don't take now.
I think that's a fair statement. It's mostly programmatic changes that we're making and that we see in the marketplace and then we're anticipating, really. And it's more flexibility to Oregon investors to help them with this. I think, again, the policy is to try to encourage as many people to look at this. Whether they use it, that's, again, a personal matter and one they have to decide.
So the revenue impact, then, to the extent that there is, would be derived from the probably very small group of investors who today might put in more than $2,000 and then not put any more money in
exactly
for the next year or so, who now will be able to put that more than $2,000 in and not put any more money in next year,
right,
but roll forward that remaining portion of their credit into the next years.
Right. Take that deduction in the
if you've got
year.
Somebody putting $10,000 in now and then $2,000 in the next year, we're already, that revenue impact isn't changing. They're already getting their credit
right.
every year. So this would just be that group that front loads it and then doesn't put any more money in for a period of time.
And again, we can talk about whether that needs to be boxed in or not. I think I would have a concern that was raised to me of maybe somebody doesn't have a taxable year. They don't have any taxes owed, and then they kind of wait until they have a taxable year. I think you should try to at least look at forcing that this would be used over
successive
time.
Yeah.
We could debate that. I guess my point was, again, why should we should try to give an encouragement like the federal government does in front-loading these, if you can do that. Again, that's a big if. But those who can, they should have some advantage in that on a state level.
And maybe Michael can answer, but do I understand? I think I've heard, too, that there is actually a surprising percentage of contributors who don't even take the subtraction, put the money in and don't take the subtraction?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. For the members of for the record, my name is Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon College Savings Plan. Mr. Chair, that's correct. We've looked at what our participants are putting in every year. We've had 10,000 accounts in 2001, households contributing, and we talked to the Department of Revenue, and about 5,600 households took a deduction. So, you know, it's a great benefit to get in, but I think folks either they forget about it or they're not thinking about it at tax time, so they're not taking full advantage of that deduction at that point.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, we have been sending notices around tax time to remind people that they can take that deduction. Lead the horse to water. I mean, we do tout the deduction, and I do believe that has been one of the reasons why people have looked at this because of that opportunity. And I guess we got to explore why there aren't more people looking at that, why they haven't done that. But.
Representative Barnhart.
Well, I wonder, is this a Schedule A deduction?
No, it's on the front of the Oregon income tax return.
It's on the front.
So it's a fraction from income.
Correct.
So,
right.
So this is not. There's no reason you wouldn't.
You're not going to overlook this.
No.
There's no reason you wouldn't take it, even if you were taking the general.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's on the Form 40-S, line 18, mm-hmm. is where it says other subtractions, right. and the Department of Revenue forms say that's where you take your Oregon College Savings Plan deduction. So,
it's in the plus column, I guess, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
quit telling them about it.
All right. Thank you
I need
very
to leave.
Much. Yeah, good,
Michael,
good to see you.
Thank you.
You.
Thank you very
good
much.
Good morning with us. Michael, do you have more?
I just, Mr. Chair, run through quickly the amendments just to make sure that everybody is clear. Initially when we put this bill together, we had contemplated trying to raise the deduction. Given the current economic climate, obviously we wanted to pull that out. So the amendment actually puts us back to the original $2,000 tax deduction. So I don't want to make that clear. That's the same $2,000 in there now is what's going forward. I think the Treasurer explained pretty well the roll forward amendment. I'd be happy to answer other questions about that one. Quickly on the change in the deadline, we're really trying to mirror what folks do with their IRAs. When you're putting together your taxes, we want you to be able to take that deduction when you're putting together your deduction for an IRA to put in your college savings plan. One amendment that wasn't talked about was the public policy behind this when the legislature passed in 99 was to really have folks save for college and keep the money in there for college. And if you would take the money out non-qualified, which means you're not using it for school, currently you're not required to pay back your state tax deduction after the first year. We want to close that down. So if you would take a non-qualified withdrawal any time in the plan and you took your deduction over those years, you'd be required to pay that money back to the state government. So we want to close that loophole forever. And actually many plans around the country are doing the same thing. So right now it's only closed for 1 year. We want to close it for every year.
Did we do that 1 year last session?
We did it last session, correct.
Okay.
So if you would open an account currently and close it within the first year, you'd be required to pay that $2,000, the tax deduction back. We want to close it for every year.
Good.
So that's in the bill now. And the other piece that's in the bill that wasn't mentioned is we wanted to, on the amendments, we wanted to create a separate account that is distinct and separate from the general fund for operational purposes to fund our operational administration of the plan. And that is because we're actually, the state takes a small percentage from the trust fund, and we believe that it's proper to, if we're taking a small piece of that trust fund, it should go back and earn interest for the fund.
So that's the other amendment that wasn't.
Michael, I just want to ask you, maybe this is a conversation you have with Elizabeth, but netting out revenue impacts, I mean, can we look, will we be recouping money from some of these disqualified, the non-qualified withdrawals with this amendment? Is there a net increase in at least potential revenue from that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I believe there would be. I think what you're going to find is that folks are going to be putting money in this plan, and we're really getting great response. But you're finding that because there's only a very small penalty, which means there's a 10% penalty on the earnings that you'd pay back, there's not a great penalty to take the money out non-qualified. So I could actually get some numbers around the country that shows what those withdrawals are. But, yes, we would be recouping money from the non-qualified withdrawals. That's correct.
That'd be worthwhile. I'm trying to minimize revenue impacts here, and if we could show an upturn on that piece that maybe offsets hard to calculate revenue impact on the other piece, it'd be nice to net that out and just say, who knows, and go forward. Okay, any other questions? All right, I see we have a piece of familiar written testimony from the Oregon Revenue Coalition. Thank you very much. Anybody want to talk about this? You don't have to. We'll beat you up.
I must be a horrible for coming over. Just, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For the record,
David Williams, Oregon School Employees Association, and the Wednesday designee for the Oregon Revenue Coalition.
Lucky you.
Yes, my lucky day.
Others have just submitted written testimony. It says thanks.
Yes, yes, I know. I just wanted to clarify a little bit, and I think we are a little bit. I apologize for the last couple of weeks. We've been out ahead of ourselves, and I think we're going to be doing a broader presentation on all of our principles involved. And the main impetus for submitting testimony, and this goes to Chair Shetterly, your last question of the last testifier, and that is that we're very concerned with not sending money back out, whether even if it is for what may be perceived a valuable cause. This program very well, and this increase in deduction very well, may fit under our broader categories of tax expenditures that we view as valuable to the state. However, our bottom line for this session is that any new tax expenditure, valuable or not, needs to be offset and needs to be revenue neutral to the state. And that's my main reason for submitting testimony today.
All right.
Thank you.
Anybody want to take them on? All right. We'll let you go because it's late.
Thanks.
Okay. With that, does anybody else wish to be heard on House Bill 2664? We'll ask Elizabeth to work with Michael on giving us, or not, a revenue impact. With that, we'll bring it back with any other amendments that we might need to see. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2664. Thank you, everybody, for your time and attention today. Good meeting, and we are adjourned. Oh.